This is The Takeaway. I'm Alana Casanova-Burgess from WNYC Studios, filling in for Melissa Harris-Perry again. Good to be with you today. This is America. And for decades, we've known that there's nothing more American than apple pie. And also, chronically polluted drinking water. The latest example came around Thanksgiving, when thousands of gallons of petroleum spilled at Red Hill, a World War II-era facility in Hawaii, contaminating the drinking water near a military base. 5,000 people have since reported illnesses related to the contamination. 3,000 families have had to relocate. 93,000 people were warned to stop drinking the water. And to put that in perspective, that's just under the number of people affected in Flint, Michigan a few years ago. And the spill may be linked to an earlier one in May. And just as in Flint and other communities with contaminated water around the country, the crisis has been downplayed by top officials. Take what James Bullocky, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy, said at a hearing last week over the state's order to cease operations and drain the fuel at Red Hill.
An urgent and compelling situation, perhaps, not a crisis. I would describe a crisis as an imminent and compelling threat to human life. Okay, I've been in combat, so I know what crisis looks like. This is a situation that can be remedied with the resources that have been brought to bear. Not a crisis.
The Navy issued an apology for the comment several days later. A recent investigation found that petroleum levels in the water were 350 times above what could be considered safe. Not only that, but according to state health experts, some of the tanks in the facility have not been inspected at all in the last 20 to 40 years. One woman spoke of how the contaminated water has affected her family at a Hawaii Department of Health hearing earlier this month.
I'm here to ask why you weren't a wingman to protect my 13-month-old son that I was bathing him when I was giving him a sippy cup full of water from my faucet when he has been throwing up for days on end. I'm here to ask why you weren't my wingman, as my husband and I have had mysterious symptoms such as sore throats, burning in my stomach. I'm here to ask why you weren't there protecting my family when we made the heartbreaking choice to put my beloved dog down after a mysterious illness and thousands of dollars trying to discover why, suddenly after being healthy, she was having coughing, choking, vomiting, difficulty breathing.
Not a crisis.
Mahealani Richardson of Hawaii News Now has been reporting on the story.
So there are 20 12.5 million gallon fuel tanks. That's 12.5 million gallons each of fuel. And they sit 100 feet beneath the surface. They are buried. They are underground. And those 20 tanks sit 100 feet above an aquifer with pristine water. And for years, the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, which is the city system, has been warning that there could be a disaster because they sit above precious water. And these tanks were built during World War II by the military, by the Navy, as an underground fuel storage tank for an energy reserve. And so right now they are crucial for the military in terms of energy reserve, the Pacific, the Indo-Pacific theater, threats from China, threats from Russia. So there is a big battle right now in Hawaii over these fuel tanks.
And I understand 93,000 have been told not to drink the water. Is that right?
Right. So 93,000 people are on the Navy's water line. And, there's more than a million people that live on the island of Oahu. So this is only impacting people on the Navy's water line. And 93,000 people have been told, do not drink the water. So if they smell fuel, they've been told, don't bathe with it. But if they're just on the Navy's water line and they can't smell anything, then they can still use it for other purposes in their home. But 93,000 people basically using bottled water, or they've moved out into a hotel.
And there was a pipeline break way back in May. I know there was also one in November. But back in May, Navy engineers said that involved maybe 1,600 gallons of fuel. But that number has been revised, I understand.
Right. It was initially reported as only 1,600 gallons of fuel. And just within the past few days, after a contested case hearing between the Navy and State Department of Health, we now know that Navy investigators think that it could have been 19,000 gallons of fuel, and was also just revealed that that May spill could be linked to a November spill where there was 14,000 gallons of fuel. So there is a lot of distrust, quite frankly, from many people in the community, because people want to know what's going on, how much fuel has been leaking over all these years. And part of the things that have come out from this contested case hearing recently is that the DOH, the Department of Health, believes that there could be perhaps even 5,000 gallons of fuel spilled every single year. And we're just discovering more and more about this.
That contamination is shocking. But as you've reported, and as you mentioned, it's not exactly surprising, right? Local officials and environmental advocates have been warning about this for a really long time. Why did they suspect something would go wrong?
It's interesting because the fuel tanks are 80 years old and they've been sitting underground. You know, we live in a salt corrosive environment. This is Hawaii, and they have been saying for years that these tanks that were built during World War II are susceptible to leaks. Now, the Navy, for its part, has said it is not the tanks that are leaking. Any leaks that have happened have happened along the pipeline. So this pipeline is sitting above Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam, and they lead all the way to the tanks. It's a gravity system. And so since the spills have happened, they have actually shut down the Red Hill fuel tanks. But the controversy right now is that the State Department of Health, the Sierra Club, several lawmakers, a lot of the activists in the area, they want the Navy to permanently shut down the fuel tanks and to drain all of the fuel, that's millions of gallons of fuel, from the tanks. And that's what the main controversy is right now.
And what's the Navy saying in response to what the Department of Health is asking them to do?
Well, the Navy is fighting this right now. The Navy said that these tanks are crucial for international defense, and they don't want to drain the fuel from the tanks because that is a massive operation in itself. The Navy at the same time says, yes, we need to have clean, fresh water for our military families and for the Navy housing and military housing that is surrounding the base. So the Navy right now is spending millions of dollars trying to literally suck out the contaminated fuel with skilled divers who are going down deep into these holes. They're going down deep into these hot, tight spaces and using, I mean, it looks like big vacuum cleaners to me, just literally sucking out this oily water from the ground. And they've also brought in 21 massive filtration systems. They've been described as basically large Brita filters that are scrubbing the water, and they're doing this basically a neighborhood by neighborhood. And once that's finished, then they have to flush and scrub house by house by house. And so the numbers are actually really astounding. 5,000 families will have reported illnesses from the tainted water, and 3,000 people have been displaced because of this crisis.
And I understand 93,000 have been told not to drink the water. Is that right?
Right. So 93,000 people are on the Navy's water line. 93,000 people have been told, do not drink the water. So if they smell fuel, they've been told, don't bathe with it. But if they're just on the Navy's water line and they can't smell anything, then they can still use it for other purposes in their home. But 93,000 people basically using bottled water, or they've moved out into a hotel.
How can this be resolved if, I mean, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that there are local activists or local officials, there are even state officials, and they're in conflict with Navy officials who are saying that there's, you know, this is not a crisis. So who can actually step in here and force a resolution?
Well, a lot of people are looking at our four members of Congress as really the congressional team that can put the pressure on the military. You may or may not know, there is a separate Pentagon Inspector General investigation to look at the leaks, to look at the safety of the Red Hill tanks. But people are looking at our four members of Congress to put the pressure on the Navy. And for their part, the four members of Congress have not come out and said that the Red Hill tanks need to be permanently shut down and the fuel taken out. They say that they need more information, but that there is immense amount of pressure on Congress to finally act, because the criticism from many environmental activists is that Congress has failed to act because of the military's influence. And the military has vast influence in the islands of Hawaii, in terms of our economy, in terms of jobs, and just in terms of how we operate here.
You mentioned that there's a lot of distrust. What's the relationship been historically between the Navy, the space, local communities, and is there concern that other water supplies could be contaminated by the same issue?
Absolutely. I mean, just specifically relating to this issue, the immediate crisis started around Thanksgiving. And there were a series of statements by the Navy that were conflicting. Initially, they said that the water was not contaminated. And then when dozens of samples were tested, they were all below the EPA action level. So their news releases said no contamination or contamination well below action levels, but dozens of samples had trace amounts of jet fuel in it. And higher ups in the Navy said no contamination, but you know, these Navy engineers on the ground said no amount of contamination or no amount of jet fuel is acceptable. But, you know, in terms of a historical sense, Native Hawaiians, who are the indigenous people to Hawaii, have had a very long and complicated history with the Navy. And so that has sparked feelings of more resentment, feelings of control by the Navy once again. So there have been protests on the island. There have been protests in front of Navy property, and there have been promise of more protests.
Right. I mean, it's not just a health or economic concern. There's also a spiritual connection to the water for Native Hawaiian communities, right?
There is a spiritual connection. And what's really interesting, Alana, I have never seen an issue that has unified so many different people. And when I say that, I mean, you have Native Hawaiians who want these Red Hill tanks to be shut down because they are so concerned about water. You know, water is life, or ola ika wai, or they say in Hawaiian. But there are also people who are concerned as well. You have these military wives who are speaking out for their families because their husbands cannot, and they're concerned about the water. You have other people who don't live near the military housing areas or the base who are concerned that if the Navy doesn't clean up the contamination, it could spread to public areas much farther away. I mean, miles and miles away. And this is something that city Board of Water Supply engineers have been warning about, and they have felt that their cries of alarm have fallen on deaf ears. And so now people are paying attention.
Is this sort of exposing some colonial fractures?
Absolutely. Native Hawaiians, and when I say Native Hawaiians, I don't necessarily mean people who were born and raised here. I mean the indigenous culture of Hawaii, the people who have been here for much longer before basically white men came here, white people came here. And so when I say the indigenous culture, I mean Native Hawaiians. And the history of Native Hawaiians with the military has been long and complicated. From the overthrow of the monarchy, there was a point where the Navy was bombing an island called Kaho'olawe for target practice. And so that was a controversy for years, so much so in the 1970s, Native Hawaiian activists swam to this tiny island to prevent the military from using the island as target practice. So yes, there is a long history, and the Navy for its part has worked for years to build trust, to build relationships, and to really try to focus on environmental restoration on the island of Kaho'olawe and several other areas on the island of Oahu that had been used for military practice.
So what does the future look like for Hawaii's water supply?
Well, at this point, and a lot of people have asked me, is it safe to drink the public's water? And if there is to be, let's say, a hero in this story, it is the chief engineer, Ernie Lau, of the Honolulu Board of Water Supply. He has ordered more frequent testing of the public's water to make sure that the Board of Water Supply continues to deliver clean, pristine, non-contaminated water for the rest of Oahu. And I think what got people to really wake up to this situation is when people asked what was the threat to the public water situation, he basically said it is at risk, it's under threat, and he got choked up. This longtime bureaucrat got choked up saying, you know, there's still time for us to do something and to act. And when he got choked up and you could see the emotion, it was really astounding to a lot of people that we all need to wake up, we all need to act, and we all need to make sure that this drinking water remains pristine for the rest of the island.
Mehealani Richardson is a reporter and anchor with Hawaii News Now. Thank you.
Alana, thank you.
In April 2019, Rogel Aguilera Mederos was driving a semi-truck on Interstate 70 in Denver, Colorado, when his brakes failed. He crashed into stopped traffic, killing 4 people and injuring more. Earlier this month, a Colorado judge sentenced the 26-year-old truck driver to 110 years in prison. That's 110, more than a century behind bars. The judge said he had little choice because of the mandatory minimum sentencing laws in Colorado.
If I had the discretion, it would not be my sentence.
Aguilera Mederos is a Cuban immigrant who had been working out of Houston at the time of the crash. Here's his statement during the sentencing.
April 25th, 2019.
My life has been very difficult, sad, depressing, terrible, bad, since April 25th, 2019. I know that it has been heartbreaking for everyone involved in this tragedy.
In response to that sentencing, nearly 5 million people have signed a change.org petition calling on Colorado Governor Jared Polis to grant clemency or commutation as time served. Even Kim Kardashian tweeted about the case. Advocates for Aguilera Mederos are calling this a tragic accident, not a criminal act. And other truck drivers around the country are showing solidarity on social media with the hashtag #NoTrucksToColorado, saying they will not drive through the state in protest.
Patrón, tienes un viaje para Colorado. No, le digo no, para Colorado no voy yo. Okay, aquí está sus llaves. Vaya usted.
You just took this kid's whole life away over an accident. So that's all I got, man. That's ridiculous. And you know what? This truck ain't never been to Colorado, not while I've been driving it, and it ain't going to Colorado. Period.
The Jefferson County District Attorney who pursued the charges is now asking the judge for reduced sentencing, which would likely be 20 to 30 years, and a hearing is scheduled for January 13th. With me now is Allison Sherry, justice reporter at Colorado Public Radio. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Alana.
Can you walk us through what happened in the crash and what prosecutors are saying, what the defense said happened?
Yes. So he was driving from Wyoming to Texas with a big truck full of lumber. He was coming down the hills from the mountains, which is a pretty steep grade. There's actually runaway truck ramps on I-70 for trucks to get off if they lose their brakes. Prosecutors say he was driving erratically for a while. It wasn't just when he lost his brakes that he had been recklessly driving through the mountains. They have cameras and that sort of thing. Defense says he, you know, when he lost his brakes, he panicked. He did drive by a runaway truck ramp, but he didn't see it. He didn't know what to do. He was switching lanes, trying to get around different vehicles. And he had planned to, when he came down the hill, go into the shoulder and just drive it out that way, because it does eventually get flat, you know, once you get into the city. But there was another truck pulled over on the shoulder doing something. And so he, in order to avoid that truck, he ended up just sort of hugging the wheel and crashing into 28 cars, killing 4 people and injuring a number of others. You know, he was asked at the time by the police why he didn't go into the grassy median, which would have obviously avoided the vehicles. And he said he didn't want to roll the truck. So I think, you know, defense would characterize him panicking and prosecutors would characterize him having, you know, a great responsibility being a truck driver with a commercial driver's license and him making a series of bad decisions that killed people.
How did he end up with 110 years as a sentence?
So that's a product of the mandatory minimums in Colorado. He was charged with first degree assault and attempted assault on the people he killed, which are crimes of violence. Vehicular manslaughter is also, he was also charged with that, but that would not necessarily require prison time. Because he was convicted of the assault charges, both attempted and actual assault charges, those are mandatory sentences and they must be served consecutively, not concurrently. So at the time, the judge said, you know, look, I don't really have much of a choice in sentencing you to this. He didn't agree with the number, but, you know, because those charges were filed under the crimes of violence statute, they didn't have much of a choice. You know, these charges were filed probably, I don't know, because a former DA filed these charges back in 2019. Mm-hmm. There's a new DA in that district now. And that former DA is not giving interviews about his decisions at the time. Because I've been covering this for a while, I would assume the DA probably filed those assault charges because he wanted some prison time for this person, not because vehicular manslaughter, you might not have any prison time at all. But I'm not sure. You know, the result was this really large sentence. What's unclear to me, and that the current DA is not giving interviews because the case is still technically open, is why the DA, you know, who prosecuted the case in real time, you know, in October, didn't know that this could be a prison sentence, that this could be, a result of what's going to happen. But, you know, I think law enforcement would say there is this relief valve. You know, you have this huge sentence, but there's a way to go to a judge and ask for a reconsideration, which is what's happening now.
And this case, as I mentioned, has gone viral organically. Has there been any organizing efforts to get truckers activated on this case?
I think truckers have activated on TikTok and on social media on this case. There was a rally covered right before Christmas on behalf of the trucker to try to reduce his sentence or get the governor to give him clemency. The rally was held on the steps of the Capitol. And there were a number of truckers who drove by sort of honking in support during the time. But I think most of the big organization has taken place on change.org, you know, which garnered almost 5 million signatures so far for clemency on this sentence. And, you know, the truckers saying they're going to boycott. I will say no one has noticed any supply chain disruptions in Colorado. It's kind of unclear whether that's happened yet. You know, I think because this sentence is still being considered, it's possible they're waiting to see what really happens since we're kind of still in the middle of the story. But, you know, I know a lot of people are very upset.
Is Colorado a major trucker route? I mean, would that boycott be meaningful economically to the state?
Yes. I mean, you know, east-west, Interstate 70 runs through from California to the East Coast, and north-south, Interstate 25 runs all the way through. So that comes up from Texas, from Mexico, all the way up to the Canadian border. So if truckers decided to avoid I-25 or Interstate 70 through Colorado, I mean, there are obviously alternate routes through Wyoming or New Mexico or Arizona, but that would be a pretty big deal.
With all of this attention on the case and it being so high profile, are lawmakers expected to address sentencing guidelines?
Yes, there is a sentencing reform task force that's already said that they're going to look at this right away when the legislature starts to meet in January. And, you know, I think they really want a couple of things. They want more discretion from judges, and they also want more transparency. Even some of the liberal and progressive Democrats in the legislature say the sentencing laws currently are just really random. Like if you are convicted of vehicular manslaughter, you get a certain sentence in one place and a judge could give you a certain sentence in another, that there's no certainty. You know, if you're going to serve 5 years or you're going to serve 7 years, you'll serve, you know, 30% of that sentence and then be eligible for parole or something like that. There's not really any certainty there. No one really knows how long someone's going to go to prison. And I think even in this case, some people have said, look, he wouldn't serve 110 years. He'd be up for parole. If he had good behavior, he could probably get out in 30. But no one really knows that. And I think having some clarity and some transparency in the system, both for the people who are involved in the criminal justice system and victims, is what the legislature is sort of hoping to accomplish.
And there's been a formal application filed for clemency to the governor of Colorado. Has the governor responded?
He has said he will expedite consideration of this request for clemency, but he has been very silent since then. He actually, in previous years, governors have traditionally given clemency on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day to people who filed, you know, for their certain cases. He did nothing this year. He didn't touch any application, including the truckers. He may be waiting to see what the judge does.
Thank you so much, Allison Sherry, justice reporter at Colorado Public Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alana.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Alana Casanova-Burgess, in for Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway. We just heard about some of your favorite movie-going experiences of 2021. And if I can just briefly weigh in on one of my top picks for the year, I have to recommend The Green Knight. It's kind of a Christmas movie, even though it came out in the summer. It's moody and gorgeous, and Dev Patel is great in it. I was just turning the ending over and over in my brain for days afterwards. And here at The Takeaway, talking about our favorite 2021 movies means talking with the team's favorite movie critic duo. Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer is a culture critic and author of How to Be Fine. Kristen also told us about going back into public theaters for the first time.
I have to say, the first time I saw a movie in a theater after the pandemic, I almost cried because I was so grateful to be able to have that communal experience with other people, to emotionally be struck by the same things at the same times on the big screen. You know, for most of the past 2 years, it's just been me on the couch by myself, or me and my husband. So it really felt special to me the first time I actually stepped into a theater and got to experience that with others.
I think I saw Summer of Soul as the first movie in a theater. And I just found it to be so transporting. I mean, that documentary is great anyway. It's sort of like being in a concert, which also was an alien feeling that we did not get to have this year. But yeah, it was beautiful. I'd love to see it again just for like editing purposes. What did you think, Kristen?
Well, I saw it on the small screen, and the whole time I was watching it, I thought, I wish I was seeing this on a big screen because it just feels like a concert experience. The whole thing is essentially the Harlem Music Festival in 1969. I just thought, I want to be there with Gladys Knight. I want to be there with Stevie Wonder. I want to be there in this crowd with all of these people feeling a sense of community and excitement.
Yes, exactly. And dancing
yes.
Especially. Yeah.
Yes.
So, Rafer, I see that Nightmare Alley was one of your favorite films of the year. That's a Guillermo del Toro movie. People might know his work from Pan's Labyrinth or The Shape of Water. What is Nightmare Alley? I don't know that I've actually heard of it.
Well, if you're an old movie fan, you might remember the old version with Tyrone Power. It's an old film noir set in a carnival. About half of it is set in a carnival. In this version, it's Bradley Cooper plays a guy named Stanton Carlisle. He's kind of a down and outer. It's post-depression, not quite yet World War II. Gets a job at this very seedy, disreputable carnival. And he finds out that he's pretty good at being a mentalist, you know, one of these mind reader types, gets this older couple to show him the ropes and teach him this kind of dark art of reading people. And he kind of figures out that he's really good at it, takes his act on the road, becomes a big success, hits the big city. He's got a helper, Rooney Mara, named Molly, who becomes his kind of showgirl assistant. Now they're in the big cities and they're playing all the best places. And then, of course, Stanton meets his match in Kate Blanchett, who plays Lilith Ritter. And what else is she? She's a psychiatrist. And so the two of these sort of mind readers get together and they get a kind of a racket going, seeing if they can bilk rich people for money.
You barely know me. Oh, I know you well. I know you're no good. And I know that because neither am I.
That's the basic gist, based on a novel and sort of a remake of the old film noir.
And what did you like about it?
Well, I love Guillermo del Toro. I just think he's like one of the greatest filmmakers going. And I think, while I will say this is not exactly what you'd call a Christmas movie, it's not really not really light entertainment, not what you'd call a feel-good film. It is such a great movie experience. You know, we were just talking about what it's like to be in a theater and see something on the big screen. And del Toro is so great at that. You know, he really understands the subconscious and unconscious power of movies and how they work sort of like dreams and fantasies. And there's just all this great symbolism, the carnival rides, the script by Del Toro and Kim Morgan is great, all these sort of verbal foreshadowings. And it just unfolds like, I'm sorry, I can't think of a better word for it. It just unfolds like a nightmare. And your stomach is just filled with dread the entire time because you know that this is all going nowhere good. You're just not sure how. How is this all going to go so badly? And then, of course, it all does.
And Kristen, there's also Passing, written and directed by Rebecca Hall. I know it's been on a lot of best of lists because I've been personally meaning to watch it for several weeks. What should listeners know about the movie?
Passing tells the story of two African-American women with light complexions in the 1920s, and they've chosen very different paths in life. Irene is living in Harlem with her husband. He's a very respected black doctor, and she's working on behalf of, bettering the lives of other African-Americans in her community. Meanwhile, Claire is passing as white and living in Chicago with her wealthy white husband. They were childhood friends, and by chance, they're just reunited. And at first, Irene enjoys having Claire back in her life, but it doesn't take long for things to get very complicated with each woman finding things to envy in the other's life and to maybe even dislike about the other. So it's a lot about relationships. It's about race. It's about expectations and what is the easier path in life. And it's not as straightforward as, you know, either character necessarily thinks at the beginning of the movie, like what is the easier path? Because we get a glimpse of what's actually hard and what's actually easy for both of them, not just one or the other character.
I also understand that you both liked West Side Story. Full disclosure, as a Puerto Rican person, I did not love it, but go ahead. Can you make the case for why you did?
I grew up with the old version of West Side Story, the one that came out in the early 1960s. And I remember even as a kid thinking, this is kind of offensive. Why do we have Natalie Wood, who is as white and Anglo as can be, playing the Puerto Rican title role in this? Maria, why? Why are all of these people in brown face? Why does the fighting look more like ballet than like street gangs? Why is this not more cinematic? Why does the film so often feel like it's just a camera that's set on a tripod while people dance in front of it? And I feel that the new version of West Side Story fixes so many of those problems. It tries to have a cast that actually, you know, is Latino to play the Puerto Rican actors. It tries to be cinematic in a way that you know, obviously you would expect of Steven Spielberg, who is directing this. The new screenplay by Tony Kushner adds a lot more intricacy and nuance to the story, which was otherwise a little bit lacking in subtlety, a little bit lacking in intricacies, not necessarily acknowledging the realities of poverty and racism and urban renewal. I'm saying that in quotes. And so I feel like this movie does a much better job with all of that. And I just found myself captivated by it. And the music, the way the sound is mixed, it's just beautiful. I did see this one in the theater and I felt fully immersed. I felt like this is what the movies were made for. But I would love to hear, Alana, your thoughts on why you didn't like it, because I am not Puerto Rican, and I'll just own that right here and now. I'm Asian American.
Well, I hear you on the tripod problem being solved. Visually, it's a beautiful movie. I mean, I love the opening, going over all the rubble in Lincoln Square. The dancing is great. The colors of the costumes, beautiful. But it still, for me, felt like a movie that was made from a white perspective. I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but there's a detective character above Officer Krupke, who's in the original. And as he's sort of orienting us in the film, we hear him basically give like the white perspective. And to me, it felt like the whole movie stayed with that the whole way through. Like Tony gets a lot more depth with his character than Maria does. And it really just felt like it focused on the jets more than the sharks, you know? And I guess it also, I couldn't shake the feeling that it wasn't necessarily authentic. And I know that a lot of other Puerto Ricans who have seen the film also couldn't shake that feeling.
I will say that I understand everything that Alana is saying. You know, I'm half Mexican. I felt like they made a pretty good effort to make that cast, if not entirely Puerto Rican, at least try to, you know, cast Latinx performers in the roles. And I thought that was a good thing. And I actually really liked that opening monologue from the detective, from the Corey Stoll character, because I felt like he was throwing a glass of cold water on the whole Jets nativist philosophies. And the line I love in that, which comes from Tony Kushner clearly, is where he stares at them all and says, "Look at you guys, the last of the can't make it Caucasians." And I just thought that was such a great line and really like got to the heart of this whole problem that, you know, look, you know, it's gonna take more than being white to make it in the world from now on. And you guys gotta face up to it. And I thought that was in one line, I thought that really brought the whole movie up to the present day and gave it a much tougher, stronger feel. So I actually really liked that opening monologue.
Yeah, I mean, the casting was certainly Latino and they're all talented singers and dancers, but that shouldn't be the high bar. And the Spanish accents were kind of weak, but you know, I just think there are other stories to tell and other people to tell them. So I don't think it's a depiction that did Puerto Ricans any favors. Not that we need any favors. I will say this, though. There's an urban planning critique baked into this new version, and the nerd in me did appreciate that. So anyway, Rafer, the epic historical drama, The Last Duel, had a stacked cast. I think I recall Matt Damon, Adam Driver, Ben Affleck all in it. I don't really know much else about it. Why did it make your list?
Yeah, I really am in the minority on this one. I feel like neither critics nor audiences really seem to warm to this movie, and it sort of surprised me. Quick synopsis, it's a true story based on the last sanctioned duel in medieval France. Matt Damon plays this soldier named De Carouge. Adam Driver is his longtime friend, Jacques Legris, which is a great name for a villain. And then Jodie Comer plays the wife of De Carouge, Marguerite. And one day the soldier comes home and his wife says that Jacques Legris has raped her. And Legris denies this, but the couple will not let the charge drop. And through sort of various twists and turns in the weird medieval legal system, it turns out that there's really only one way to settle this, and that is with a duel to the death. And there's a catch to this for the wife in particular. If the other guy wins, then she'll be burned alive for lying. So the well, I was just about to say the stakes, sorry for the pun, the stakes are very high in this. And I thought it was just riveting. It's set up in kind of a Rashomon way where you hear the soldier's story first, you hear Legree's story second, and then you hear the wife's story third. And it's pretty clear that the wife's story is the one that is going to be the truest to life. And I thought that was a brilliant construction. The script was great. It's Affleck and Damon back together again after Good Will Hunting. They wrote the script, but they wrote it with Nicole Holofcener, who's a great filmmaker in her own right. Friends with Money. She did the screenplay for Can You Ever Forgive Me with Melissa McCarthy. I just thought it was a really intelligent, frightening and horrifying version of a rape accusation. And I thought it was great the way that you could see how some things have changed and some things haven't, and you know what it means to be the accused, what it means to do the accusing, the way society treats you, the way people split down the middle and who believes you, who and who doesn't. And even though, you know, no one gets burned alive anymore for it, they kind of do figuratively in some ways still. The risks are still very great for women to bring these kinds of accusations. And there was something metaphorical about that that I thought was really powerful. But I will tell you, it did not do well at the box office. I know very few people who are not film critics who have seen it. And I know very few people who are even aware of it. It kind of came and went, but I loved it. It's up in my top five, my top three.
Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer is a culture critic and author of How to Be Fine. Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
That's all we have for you folks today. We appreciate you tuning in. Also, if you missed anything or want to listen back, check out our podcast. And of course, call us with your show ideas and suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Alana Casanova-Burgess, in for Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway. Talk to you tomorrow.